For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Last week, we looked at three cultural myths when it comes to peace, that when you get depressed, when you get anxious, you can kind of, you know, go to the escape hatch of digital media, pulling out the phone, maybe a romantic affair, or perhaps materialism, that you can be a really important big person. And we saw that these were myths, that when you compare them with the data and the research, that these actually don't procure happiness. In fact, in many cases, just the opposite, that there's actually deleterious effects on your emotional life that actually hurts your emotions. And the question is, why? Why is it that these things, which seem so common to happiness, would do such a thing? Well, this relates to a phenomenon referred to by social scientists as the hedonic treadmill or hedonic adaptation. When you think of the word hedonic, hedon means happy, pleasure. Think of hedonism. Somebody going for hedonism is just going for all-out pleasure. And hedonic adaptation is basically that you are going to go with a human tendency, the human tendency to quickly return to a relatively set range of happiness. Not a set point, but a range, that there's a certain range that you're naturally going to drift back to. And so it might look something like this, where you're happy, and then it just goes right back to normal. Then you crash your car, but then, you know, a week or two later, you're back to normal. Then that girl says yes to a date, you're feeling happy, and then you're back to normal. Then she actually goes out with you, and then you're dumped, and then you're, you know, sad, but then you're back to normal. And this is basically they call it the hedonic treadmill. Why? Because you can run 7 miles an hour, 8 miles an hour, 9 miles an hour, but really you're still in the same place. So no matter how much you try to be happier, you're going to come back to the set range. And with each of these myths that we looked at last week, we can see that it gives us a dopamine spike, a happiness spike, but then it leaves us right where we were. Just to give you an example, Philip Brickman out of Northwestern University, he said that lottery winners were very happy to win their money, but they returned to their former emotional state only 8 weeks after hitting the jackpot. So they became a millionaire. They were really happy for 60 days, and then they realized, I'm still me. And they woke up in their same skin, only now they have $1 million in the bank, and you go right back to normal. And so this is the same phenomenon that we're seeing, that you go up, you go down, and the question becomes, are there concrete ways to build happiness in your life? You know, is it that we're just fated to be a certain level of happy, and that's it? I think so, yeah. That brings us to our topic for tonight, three proven practices that will increase happiness. And we're going to appeal to the scientific literature as well as to the Bible to demonstrate that these are real and that these can change your life. Number one, the power of quality friendships. As you read the literature on happiness or what's called subjective well-being, you see repeatedly that the number one correlate for a happy person is their relationships. If you want to know if somebody's happy, all you have to do is just look at their friendships. And that is the number one predictor of happiness. George Vallant, he was a guy who took over from an earlier researcher, Robert Waldinger, from back in the 30s. He ran this study, the famous Grant study of Harvard sophomores back in 1937. They were given this grant to study these 19, 20-year-old guys in Harvard and to make this a longitudinal study that would follow them until death. The study is still going today. Robert Waldinger had to pass it off to another guy. He died. And then that guy had to pass it off to Vallant. And then Vallant had to pass it off to somebody else. And so this is the longest, what's called a longitudinal study. It's not a big sample size. This is just 268 men. And yet it's the longest sample that we've seen on subjective well-being. They followed these men over 70 years. They reached a certain point where they kept interviewing these men every 6 months to a year. And they hit the 2000s, and they said, we should interview the wives. And so they interviewed the wives, and the wives famously said, well, it's about time. They interviewed us. Well, Vallant, he said this, to summarize this research, he said, the 75 years and $20 million expended on the grand study points, at least to me, to a straightforward five-word conclusion. What did all of it tell us? All the money, all the research for these men that were studied through the biggest war the world has ever seen, through depressions and everything else, and alcoholism, business success. What is the conclusion? He says, quote, happiness is love, full stop. When you think about what makes somebody a happy person, it wasn't that they were a CEO. It wasn't that they were famous. One of the men in this study was none other than JFK. And they can't release his records because it's confidential, because he was a president. There were senators, everything else. But the people that were the happiest were those that had quality relationships. The number one predictor of happiness is social aptitude. It wasn't education. It wasn't wealth. It wasn't good looks. It was the ability to get along with other people in relationship. So that would be a really long study, a longitudinal study. Now let's look at a really wide study. This is from Julianne Holt Lunston. She's a psychologist. This is a meta-analysis, so a big analysis, of 148 studies and 300,000 people. Lunston wanted to find out, you know, what would actually lower your lifespan. And she looked at something like air pollution. And this had the odds of decreasing your lifespan by 5%. That's pretty serious. What about obesity? In this country, huge problem, big problem. Obesity, that wasn't a pun, by the way. That was just I was just using that as an adjective. Okay. Obesity, 20% decrease to your lifespan. Whoa, that's huge. That's so serious. That's an epidemic in the United States. What about excessive alcohol usage? This would be over 6 drinks per day. That's a lot. That would be considered, what would you call it? An alcoholic. That's serious. Well, this would decrease your mortality by 30%. That's huge. Boy, I would hate to see a loved one fall into alcoholism. Boy, that would eat me up inside. What about loneliness? Holt Lunston found that it had the odds of decreasing your mortality by 45%. Worse than drinking, worse than smoking, 15 cigarettes a day, 3/4 of a pack, worse than all of this. Some of these worse than them put together. Loneliness. We're social creatures. And to be isolated, you know, just with a studio apartment and 4 walls and a toilet and, a furnace, and maybe one window, it's like being in prison. That's what that's like. Not having any kind of meaningful social interaction. That's killing us. It's literally killing us. Ed Diener, who is the godfather of happiness studies, what he coined subjective well-being, his literature and his writing has been quoted something like 10,000 times by other social scientists. So this guy is a pace setter in his field. He's at the top of the pack. Him and Martin Seligman, who's also a very bright, accomplished psychologist, they studied these different undergraduates, and they parsed out who are the top 10% of the happiest undergraduates out there. And they discovered that each one of these people had something in common, each and every one. And it wasn't that they exercised. It wasn't that they ate right. It wasn't that they got good grades. It wasn't that they were wealthy. As important as all those things are, each one of these people, the happiest 10%, they had, quote, good social relationships. Boy, that must be some kind of a coincidence that the happiest people are the most connected people. Social scientists tell us that we're even happier when talking to strangers. So even talking to someone whom you don't know, this makes you actually happier than the alternative. Nick Epley out of the University of Chicago would take the public transit into work every day. And he's a researcher out there, and he kept looking around the public transit, Chicago, and he just kept noticing, you know, this kind of a picture here where everyone's on their headphones. They're all plugged in. Nobody makes eye contact. Nobody looks at each other. We just look down, and we listen to our Radiohead, and we don't look at each other the whole time. And Nick Epley was wondering, I wonder if we could do an experiment about this. One YouTube video that went viral was this guy here. He takes it a step further. He did virtual reality. She's just like, this guy is nuts. Why did I pick this seat? He's crazy. Man, and that is, give it 10 years. That'll seem totally normal. All of a sudden, we'll be sitting there in our little, you know, matrix thing plugged in the back of our head, just thinking, what was that movie where everyone's obese? Wall-E. Yeah, it'll be like Wall-E. Well, Nick Epley had this idea. He said, I'm going to put people on the public transit, and I'm going to have three different groups. Group number one, they're the solitude group. So they go on the public transit, whether it's a train, a subway, a bus, and they don't talk to anybody. Solitude. Then there's the control group. You just do whatever you want. You do what you normally do on a train, on a subway, or on a bus. Then there's the connection group. This is the group that has to be on a subway, a train, or a bus, and they have to go talk to a complete stranger and strike up a conversation. Now, right there, let's stop. Which one would you rather be? Would you rather be the solitude, the control, or the connection group? For me, I would want to be the control, so I could just do whatever I wanted. Or the solitude, you know, but definitely not the connection group. To go up and talk to a stranger on the subway, that just sounds, what's the word of our age? Awkward. That's just too awkward to be able to talk to a stranger. And yeah, what did they find? You with me here? Experiment number 1A. They found that the connection group, after this experiment, way more positive. The control group, nothing. And the solitude group, way less positive. How about that? Here's the kicker. What did these same people predict before they acted on the experiment? They predicted exactly the opposite. The solitude group thought that I'd feel a lot more positive just having my earbuds in and ignoring everybody. In fact, it was completely flip-flopped. The connection group, the people who felt like, oh, I would just be too awkward to talk to a stranger, it'd be too weird, they'll think I'm a psycho. You start to talk to people, they'll think you're weird, and I just wouldn't want to do that. They predicted, oh, that would be way less positive, and in fact, it's a mere opposite. I hope you can see that. In the second experiment, experiment 2A, same thing, the same study. This was on buses. So a little bit more intimate of a situation. And the solitude group way down, the control group way down, and the connection group way up. That people actually feel better when they communicate, even with a complete stranger. And again, what did they predict before the experiment? Completely the opposite. I'd feel better if I didn't talk to anybody. Well, Epley and his colleague, Julianne Schroeder, had this to say. They said extroverts believed that they would have a more pleasant experience interacting with another person in an extroverted fashion than introverts predicted. I don't know what that looks like because I'm not an extrovert. But apparently extroverts were like, we'll go and talk to people on the bus and it's going to be amazing. In reality, they write, both introverts and extroverts reported a more positive experience while acting extroverted in a social interaction than while acting introverted. I read that and I thought to myself, wow, that is a real push for me. As somebody who is more inclined toward introversion, where I just want to be by myself, to actually step out there and to start to act and to, it might be that I'm feeling a certain way, but as I start to speak, I start to talk, all of a sudden I start to feel better. How about that? When you actually act and interact socially, it's better for you. Catch this. Participants reported being significantly more interested in talking to others than they thought others were in talking to them. I would totally feel the same way. Me going up and talking to a person, I bet I would just think the whole time, oh, they don't want to talk to me. They wouldn't want to talk to me. They're going to think this is awkward, weird, strange, bizarre behavior. In reality, all who returned our surveys reported talking with the person they attempted to connect with, and not a single person reported being rebuffed. There wasn't a case where people tried to initiate conversation and the person shut them down. Commuters appeared to think that talking to a stranger posed a meaningful risk of social rejection. As far as we can tell, it posed no risk at all. So much for that idea that people don't want to talk. People are lonelier than ever. They have a cry of the soul that they want to connect with other people, and they're dying to talk to other people. And they're looking for a normal, regular, socially adjusted person to come and talk to them and be a friend. I guess the fear isn't in them, it's in us. That we're too inhibited, too reserved to want to reach out and love to other people. Well, we see too that relationships would extend to experiences together. That actually investing in experiences, and it seems to me this has to be social experiences. I suppose you could do an H.D. Thoreau and go to Walden Pond out by yourself, and that could be an experience in and of itself. But as you look at the research, it's usually an experience that we do together. We find that experience leads to greater happiness, to be with other people, to go and take trips, to do stuff, to play sports, to go fishing, to go on a walk, to take vacations, stuff like that, makes you a more adjusted, happy person. It also has longer lasting effects. Like if you had the difference between spending $200 on a trip with friends, or you had the difference between that or buying a $200 sound system, the trip will have longer lasting effects on your happiness than the material object. Why is that? Because when you get the thing, when you get the object, you have it, dopamine spikes, and you go right back down to normal. Whereas the experience, I don't know about you, sometimes we sit around in these circles and we tell stories about our adventures together, and you know, we're starting to talk, and we're like, remember when we were out there, and you know, and that guy was there, and there was that horse, and remember those hillbillies were out there, and they tried to shoot us, true story, and we're sitting there just laughing, and it's just like, yeah, that's really funny, and so we can share that experience for 30, 40 years, whereas sitting around saying, remember that one time in 2019 I bought that sound system? And you can just hear a pin drop in the room. Everyone's just like, great job. It's better to talk about with others. We went on a camping trip with the family recently, and we had a bunch of fun and experiences and stuff together. And I remember that whole week I was just sharing it with people. Imagine how weird that would be if I was sharing about my car that I bought. And I'm just talking about my car with people. Think about that. Somebody sharing an experience versus sharing about a material object that they bought. They found that sharing about experiences makes you a more interesting person. It also makes you less likely to be competitive. So let's say you go on a hike and I go on a hike. When we meet up together and I say, yeah, I just got back from hiking. You did? I did too. We're not trying to compete with each other normally. You know, normally, you're just like, so what was your hike like? Oh, man, we went up on this, you know, certain mountain and had this kind of an ascent and we saw this kind of animal and blah, blah, blah. And it's like we're sharing and we're connecting. When you talk about your car, when you talk about your house and you're sharing that with each other, it leads to competition. Where we're trying to compete with each other. We're trying to show off all of our toys, and this leads actually to angst rather than happiness. Every year, for the fourth year in a row, we like to do a Halloween party for all the kids in the neighborhood and some of our friends. We get 30, 40 kids out to this thing and all the parents. And we spend $300, $400 on this party. And we get all these kids together. And, you know, we also eventually we scare them. So we had this year, we had 9 zombies that, you know, crawled over the fence and came. None of the kids saw. And they're coming after him, you know. And hats off to this guy here, Eddie. I get to make a video afterward, and I look at that video, you know, throughout the year. And then I get to anticipate that experience. And you're like, well, that's a real waste of $300 or $400 on food and candy and zombies and stuff. But to me, it makes me very happy to see all the kids together and the families together, and it's an experience. That is, buying some kind of a thing for my house just wouldn't compare. Well, this would make sense under a Christian worldview. You know, why is it that we yearn for relationship? Why is it that we would be unhappy? Why is it that one of the worst punishments there is in life is solitary confinement? That's one of the things that drives people insane, is to be locked up without human connection. This is because we were created in the image of God. That God is a personal, loving being existing in the Trinity. There's one God and three separate persons, three centers of self-consciousness, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And according to Jesus in John 17:5, these three persons have been loving each other for eternity past, and they will do this for eternity future. So, in the very center of God is love, giving and receiving love. And when he made us in his image, that's how he designed us, is to love and to be loved. It's interesting when we read the creation account of the first humans. God creates the first human, and there's that repeated refrain, you know, he created this, and it was good, and he created that, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then Genesis 1:31, and it was very good. And then you get to chapter 2, verse 18, and God sees that Adam was alone, and he says, it is not good for him to be alone. How could it not be good? He's in an incredible Edenic state in Eden. He's got God there with him, and God says, because I created you to connect. That's why. And it isn't good for humans by virtue of the fact that we're created to be relational. It's not healthy. It's subhuman to be in an isolated state. And so this would explain perfectly why we yearn for connection. Yes, from a biblical worldview, happiness comes from the spiritual and the relational side of life. And we could roll out passage after passage in the Bible. But this is what the Bible says. This is where it's all at, is in relationships. That's what makes you a happy person. Not your toys, not your stuff, not your career. As important as those things are, relationships, love relationships, is at the center. Well, number two, the power of thoughtful gratitude. Oh, this is a lesson I've had to learn and relearn over the years. A quintessential passage that an older believer shared with me is this, Philippians 4:6. This is from Paul, one of Jesus of Nazareth's disciples. Paul says this, he says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving. How about that? So I'm in an anxious state, and God is saying, you got to turn over from anxiety into gratitude. What are you grateful for? Then at that point, you make your request known to God. You say, God, I'm feeling anxious about this. And you just pass these things off to God where they belong. I can't change this. It's out of my control. I'm going to stop controlling it, and I'm going to give it to you. In the meantime, I'm thankful for what you've given me. And at that point, God says, the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. To be guarded, just that picture, that in an anxious state, a depressed state, to have your heart guarded by who? By Jesus Christ. And how do we gain access to this? We gain access through gratitude. Well, the scientific literature backs this up. Here's Martin Seligman. He is the godfather of the positive psychology movement. And he has really made a huge strides in this area. Back in 2005, he showed that there's this thing called the gratitude visit. This is where the psychologist tells the patient, you got to write out someone for whom you're incredibly thankful. And you write out why. It could be a teacher, a friend, a parent, a sibling, whoever. And you write out how that person changed your life and how thankful you are for them. And then unbeknownst to the patient, the counselee, you find out later that you have to go visit the person and read it to them. Well, you should look up some of the videos on YouTube where people do this, and they show up and read it to the individual. Very powerful. And when they do this, they show an incredible increase in subjective well-being. Happiness goes up immediately by 10%. And I would have to imagine pouring your heart out to a person whom you love, that would lift your happiness. The problem is, a week later, this cuts in half. Day 7, you're down to 5%. And 6 months later, it's basically negligible. There's nothing. No change. Whereas, he found in this exercise called the Three Good Things exercise, an exercise where you just sit there every day, nothing complicated, and you just ask yourself, what am I thankful for today? And you list those things out. You might journal it. You might say it. You might pray it. This is a secular study, so they don't care. They found that after a week, so you got to wait a week of doing this, your happiness goes up by 2%. Oh, there you go. That's not going to do much at all. But after a month, your happiness goes up to 5%. And after 6 months, your happiness goes up to 9% what it was. That is almost equivalent to that first day of reading the gratitude letter to a person. But it's going to take 6 months. This is going to have to be a change of lifestyle, developing gratitude where you become a more grateful person. If that's the case, the literature is showing an increase, and there's an incredible decrease, 28% decline in depressive symptoms during that time. So an increase in happiness and a decrease in depression. And I've talked to so many people about this. I felt like this was like the hidden secret, the silver bullet. I was so impressed with this, and it's changed my life. And I've talked to people, and they've been into it, and they've done it, you know, for weeks and months. And then I've been like, so how does it make you feel after one of these sessions? You know, 5-10 minutes of giving thanks and just being grateful. How do you feel? And I've heard everything under the sun, you know, happy, peaceful, just calm, and everything's in control. And then they'll tell me, yeah, but I stopped doing it. And I'm like, well, why? And they're like, I don't know, but I stopped doing it and it stopped working. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of how it works. That's like me saying, I'm going to prescribe you this pill. And you got to take the pill every day if you want to feel happy. And you come back and, you know, chew me out and say, well, I just don't feel happy anymore. Well, what went wrong? Well, I stopped taking the pill. Well, yeah, that's going to be a big problem if you stop doing this. But I can tell you, with a straight face, every single person I've talked to who's gotten into this, this is like the pill that brings health to your soul, to your emotional life. People who are so unstable, they get into gratitude and all of a sudden they are changed over time. It's incredible. Robert Emmons, who's on the West Coast, he had a study of three different groups. There was the blessings group, the hassles group, and then the events group. So the blessings group, they had to give, you know, three things they were happy for every day. And then there was the hassles group. They had to write out three things for which they were angry every day, things that were really bothering them every day. And then there was just the events group where they just said, just write something, okay? Three things, things that happened. What they found was the blessings group was 25% happier, they had fewer health complaints, and they exercised more. Now you're like, oh, I see. So this is reverse causation. You got the people who exercised more and they were happier. No. From the beginning of the study to the end of the study, exercise increased by 1.5 hours per week. And fewer health complaints, not as sick to their stomach, headaches. A lot of this went away probably because stress, anxiety, depression produces adrenaline, cortisol, flooding your system. And it has a physiological effect on your body. This isn't just like breathing out the bad energy and breathing in the good energy, something like that. That's New Age thought. We're talking scientifically. When your emotional state changes, this has a physiological effect on your body. And he also found that optimists had a 50% lower risk of premature death. And optimists had a 30% less of a risk for coronary deaths. And I know I'm a pessimist because when I read that, I feel really worried about my future. Scary. Alex Wood, who himself was originally a skeptic of this gratitude research, it sounded like New Age thinking, where we just think hard enough and then it happens. So he was a critic. He came around out of the University of Stirling. He said, 12 studies have supported the link between gratitude and subjective well-being. Thankfulness predicted significantly lower risk of major depression, generalized anxiety disorder, phobia, nicotine dependence, alcohol dependence, and drug abuse or dependence. Additionally, thankfulness was related to a much lower risk of bulimia nervosa. Increased gratitude may have benefits for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. So this goes everything from the, I don't want to talk down to these, but the more simple mood disorders to the more complex mood disorders. And this is having an effect on all these. Jeff Huffman out of Harvard Medical School, he gave his suicidal patients, so these would be serious cases, 9 different positive psychology exercises. And guess which ones were the best? Number one, the gratitude letter. And number two, the three good things exercise. Yes, this can work wonders on your emotional state. Well, growing in gratitude, how do we do this? Asking ourselves the question, what am I thankful for today? You know, yesterday I may have been thankful for my friend, but why am I thankful for him today? What about him makes me thankful today? I like to do this when I get time with God. It's a really great way to start your time talking to God. It's just telling God the things for which you're thankful. And sometimes I don't have much in the tank, and so I just say, God, I'm really thankful for this coffee. It smells pretty good. That's about all I got. And then all of a sudden I thank him for that, and then I'm like, you know, I'm thankful that my car started today. Praise the Lord. That doesn't always happen. And then I'm thankful for that new album I got from my buddy. I really like that. You know, something new for once. And then I thank him, you know, I'm looking forward to this other thing. This weekend we're getting away, our friends. And all of a sudden you see one thing lighting off another to another, and all of a sudden you start to feel, it doesn't happen at first, but all of a sudden you start to feel more grateful. Trying to replay what your life was like before you met your best friend. Before a significant thing happened in your life. What was it like before that happened? For me, I like to think back of what it was like before I met Christ. My life was moving aimlessly. I didn't know what my life was about. Very confused. It was kind of an existential crisis. You know, why am I here? What is the purpose? And I think back on that and I'm like, whoa, these problems I'm having today, nothing in comparison to the way it was before. Nothing. Remembering great moments in your life. I like to keep a Word document on this myself. I call it great moments in my life. And I blurred that out because I don't want to read those to you. But I keep them, and it's about 8 pages long. And I can just read through these, one after the other, and to see the way that I've been loved, people who have loved me. I'm not an easy person to love. And yet I'm the beneficiary of friendship, love, seeing the answers to prayer. I'm not that good at prayer. And yet I see, even as somebody like me who's not that good at it, can start to see God has answered a number of prayers I would have never thought possible. And keeping track of these things, Psalm 103 says, may I never forget the good things you have done for me. Oh yeah, we got to think about this and record it. Then there's also negative visualization. You ever seen Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life? What would things be like if that went wrong? What would things be like if this never happened? And you start to picture things in your life. What if it went the other way? Things we take for granted. Things we think were just, well, I deserve that. What if that wasn't in your life? What if it was plucked away? Then what? Well, that's gratitude. Number three, love therapy was a term that was coined by Ralph Ankinman, who is a PhD. And he believed that the key to a happy life was to give out love to other people. And since that time, we've seen in the scientific literature that he was right all along. It didn't hurt that he was a Christian, and he got this idea from the Bible, that at the center of the Bible is love, giving out love. And he thought probably the key to most of our issues is to love other people, a failure to love. He was right. Sacrificing our time and energy helps with a number of different things. One study was done, UCLA neuroscience study. They gave an option. Group number one, you just had to hold your loved one's hand when they were getting shocked. And they gave you the shock, too, so you knew how bad it was. And then they shocked your loved one. I know, it sounds really barbaric and stuff. It's totally a real study. And then group number two, you got to watch your loved one go through the shock, electrical shock, and you got to squeeze a stress ball. Guess which group did better? The holding the loved one's hand. No surprise there. It increased the caregiving system of the brain. It decreased the amygdala, which is kind of the lower brain. It's there for emotion and anger and that kind of thing. That was decreased. The oxytocin, the dopamine was released. How did the stress ball do? Not well. Not that well. Didn't help at all. Sitting there pumping away at that stress ball, people didn't feel any better than they did before. What about the time scarcity study out of Wharton School of Pennsylvania? This was a study where people were complaining in this business that we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time. I wish I had more time. We need more time. They're not giving us enough time. And so group number one, they gave him an extra hour of free time for work. There you go. Keep the change. Group number two, they told them, we're going to give you an extra hour, but instead of working on your work, help your friend out with his work. So you got an extra hour to help a colleague. Which group did better? Group number two. They found in this group that helped other people, they felt more capable, more competent, and it changed the way they looked at their own workload and work pressure and stress. That it could be the very time where I'm feeling like I don't have enough time, that could be precisely the moment when I need to give a little bit of time away to other people to help them out. There was a study of lower-income people in Detroit, 846 of them, and they just asked them two questions. Number one, tell us about the stressful events in your life. And number two, how much time do you spend helping others around you? Two questions, pretty simple. What they found was that for each stressful event, those who didn't regularly help others, this increased their risk of death by 30%. The people, now these are people that were in the slums of Detroit, the people who were in hard cases, the people who actually helped other people during times of stress, the effects of stress had no effect on their lives. The people who held back from loving others, these are the ones that stress actually killed them. There's been correlations here with sacrificing your time and energy. Those with PTSD, you know, survivors of major natural disasters, if you get them right away back into volunteering to help out, this lowers their post-traumatic stress. Widowers, being with your husband, your wife, for decades and then losing them. Oh, that would be a heartbreaking scene. To get them into volunteering, to get them into caregiving and helping out other people, alleviated their depression. People with chronic physical pain, when they got these people into becoming peer counselors, it helped with their pain, helped with their depression as well. Well, so many different ways here. What if I told you that you could actually buy happiness? You can. If you spend your money right, you can buy happiness through what's called pro-social spending. When you spend money on things which are good for other people, this makes you a happier person. Giving, not spending, makes you happier. This was true, not just in rich countries like the United States, but internationally, cross-culturally, in Canada, India, and in Uganda. In one of the cases, they gave money to a person in Uganda, and they had the decision of whether they were going to use that for medicine for their own family or to help a family that was in worse need. They gave the money away, and they found that that person was actually happier than the people who spent it on their own. Well, this shouldn't surprise us from a biblical worldview. After all, Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Blessed. Blessed. What does that mean? It means fortunate, happy, or privileged. Makarios. This word throughout the Greek language is always used of a happy person. I abhor these translators who are always saying it's more blessed. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed. It should be translated happy. Happy are those who give rather than receive. That the way we were created was to give out to others, and in doing so, that's the key to a happy life. Do you know what Jesus' most repeated teaching was in the Gospels, more than any other teaching? It was this right here. It's a little riddle. Jesus used to say this. It's in all four Gospels, and it's in two Gospels twice. So he must have been saying this all the time. He says, whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever wishes to lose his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. In Jesus' mind, in God's economy, the key to a happy life is not to hold on to your life. That's how you lose it. The key is to give away your life, and that's how you keep it. And this is true. The medicine to most of our problems and maladies is that I need to get the focus off of myself and start to nurture and care and love other people. And this is really the medicine for our disease, that we start to realize my problems kind of fall into the background and I start to care for another person. And this is God's way of taking care of us. Well, as we conclude tonight, we're looking at this subject, you know, so this is real easy. So all I need to do is become a more relational person, a more grateful person, and a more loving person. Oh, wow. How do I do that? If only it was this easy. Well, I would like to suggest that you can't. You can't do this. You know, when it comes to certain things in life, you know, not eating the chocolate cake, you know, showing up to work on time, quitting cigarettes, you know, stuff like that. That's something we can do. When it comes to fundamentally changing your heart to becoming a more grateful, loving, relational, other-centered person, that's not something that we have the power to do. That's something that we need to depend on another to do that for us. And basically what I'm saying here is, in effect, is that we need an outside, transcendent, loving source to come into our lives to change us into these kind of people. And the good news is, there is such a source. Jesus Christ was the most relational, grateful, and loving man that ever walked the face of the earth. In Luke 6:35, Jesus said, God is loving even to ungrateful and wicked people. And Jesus is God. And Jesus did the unthinkable. He took up the cross. He was hanged there. He was murdered. He was butchered. And he gave everything he could for each one of us. But what we need to do is not become a better person. What we need to do is realize that we're not a good person. And just to receive what Jesus did for each one of us. That's it. I don't know if you've heard that before. It's really that simple. Just to receive the gift of Christ. In the words of Jesus, he said, here I am. I stand at the door and I knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and I'll eat with him and he with me. Look at this here. So Jesus is at the door. He's knocking. Jesus knocks on the door. Jesus won't knock down the door. So we have free will here, okay? It's not like he's going to force us into a relationship. But maybe you're here tonight and you're realizing, maybe that's what I'm missing. Maybe that's what I need. I can hear his voice. I can see God brought me here tonight. I can sense him palpably. And I want to open the door. Let me tell you something. That is something you will not regret. Opening up the door to your Creator and inviting him into your heart, accepting his love and his forgiveness. This is one of the most wholesome, awesome things you could ever do. And once he comes into your life, it's so cool that he starts to work with you and change you into a more loving and grateful, relational, confident person. And you could do that here with us tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.